This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Drinking in Poetry. 100 years ago, in 1919, the noble experiment began. After decades of political activism against the consumption of alcohol, Congress passed the Volstead Act. The next year, Prohibition began and would last until 1933. To mark the anniversary, we are going to ponder what America was about to outlaw. Liquor, beer, spirits, booze, wine, grog, hooch, firewater, moonshine, tipple. Several years ago, about this time of year, we got to thinking about poems involving humanity's favorite drug of choice. I asked two poetry-loving journalists who have tossed back a few in their day to meet me in a bar and read a few of their favorite booze-infused poems. For many years, Rosie Schapp was the drinks columnist for the New York Times Magazine, and she's the author of the memoir Drinking with Men. Jeff Gordonier is currently the food and drinks editor for Esquire magazine. Rosie and Jeff are friends who have both written articles for our website. We met at a shrine to booze in Lower Manhattan, a dark and spacious place called the Temple Bar. When our drinks arrived, Jeff and Rosie started out by talking about the kinds of drinking poems they were drawn to.
And I, you know, it's funny, when I was looking for poems for this, I found myself turning to a lot of the New York school poets, like Frank O'Hara and Kenneth Koch and that crowd, because and they describe a kind of happy, sad delirium with drinking that I thought was very New York.
Yeah, it's hard to find an unambiguously happy drinking poem. I think good poets are too smart for that. And another thing that I found is there are far fewer drinking poems by women, because it's impolite, I think, you know, for women to really talk about bar culture and drinking culture. Even in New York is, you know, to be a woman who loves bars and is always part of bar culture and is a regular, even here it's a little bit of an anomaly. Even here it's a little bit inappropriate. You know, it's still sort of a male world, bar culture.
Well, when it came time to choose poems, you guys didn't have any problem finding drinking poems to talk about. Do you have any, Rosie, that are written by women?
I do. I found a wonderful poem that I had first read a few years ago called Beer by Alicia Ostreicher.
Alicia Ostreicher, who is in her 70s, I think, right now. And I think she lives in New York. I've recorded her once or twice. Tell us about this poem and then read it for us.
Well, I think, you know, it kind of hits that sweet and sour place where bar culture is often written about, that there's something wonderful and comforting and ultimately lovable about it, but at the same time there's an undercurrent of menace. At the same time there's something a little sad about some of the regulars. And at its best, when we're really deep in bar culture, we love the regulars for their sadness in some ways. You know, I think one of the great things about regularhood is that you can be completely yourself, that you show up at your bar for a beer or for a daiquiri or for a Manhattan, and you don't have to put on your best, cheeriest face. If you're in a crap mood, your friends at the bar will accept you in your bad mood. There's kind of a space for everyone in a good bar. Beer. After the store and the gas station close, there is still the bar, with its real animal heads on the wall, alert and thoughtful under their antlers, neither refusing nor rebuking you. It's television they have tucked under the ceiling, like a man holding a ping pong ball under his chin, where it yammers like a nervous female who uses her hands more than a person needs to. Your neighbors will be playing pool, sadly and easily, as they always do. The teenage women hyped up, more serious than their boyfriends, the drunkards loud and wide like semis cruising down the interstate, their bellies stacked, a proud, rounded lifetime record of beer to show. The snaky boys keeping their angular mouths shut, chalking their cues. It could be raining or snowing outside. Night after night, somebody puts, "You can take this job and shove it," on the jukebox, and you can hardly help loving the familiar bodies, the sounds, the movements, and how everything goes together for hours.
Let's drink to that.
Cheers.
Okay, Jeff, so we just heard Beer by Alicia Ostreicher. It is your turn. What drinking poem do you have for us?
Well, I'm a big fan of this Korean poet named Ko Eun, who is a fascinating poet and a fascinating person. He's got this sort of Zen Buddhist streak, but he's also kind of a punk. Uh-huh. And he seems to live hard and wild and then to write about it in a really captivating, honest way. And so I stumbled, so to speak, upon this poem called Zhongno Street. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. We'll just have to wing it. It goes like this, Zhongno Street. As I went strolling down Zhongno Street in Daegu, I bought and drank a bottle of schnapps. That's the whole poem. I love it. I love that feeling. It's a whole bottle.
Whole bottle. He must
in the street.
The implication there is a big time hangover from schnapps.
I know. Sorry. There's some agony involved. I can feel that.
Always.
But I can feel the ecstasy as well. I mean, I can feel the delirium of walking down the street with that bottle of schnapps. And I kind of like the idea of his being alone and just celebrating, you know, looking at the stars. And there's that kind of euphoria of drunkenness that can be strangely solitary sometimes. All right. You know, though similar, I just want to read one more that's similar to the Koan poem.
Yeah.
This is by Kenneth Koch.
Yeah.
So it's got that kind of New York jubilant, casual quality, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
When he nailed that, he would really nail that. And so this one is called To High Spirits. You know, he had a series of poems that he would address to various components of his life.
That was called New Addresses, I think.
That's right, exactly, yeah. So this one is called To High Spirits. And it's obviously a bit of a wink to the William Carlos Williams poem about the plums in the icebox.
Mm-hmm.
You have taken the vodka that I was probably saving for tomorrow. Go on and take it. For there's more enterprise in waking naked. That's the whole poem. Short is good with drinking poems.
Short is good, yes.
It is.
Yeah.
I feel the hangover in that one, too, I got to tell you.
It's such a funny word. There's more enterprise in being naked?
Waking naked.
Waking.
Yeah. That's crucial. Like, I see the bed, I see the ceiling, I see him perhaps moaning and groaning, but... It was a night to savor, I think.
Of course, it's riffing on Williams, but it's also riffing on Yeats.
Oh, yes,
the final lines of A Coat, for there's more enterprise in walking naked.
Oh, my God.
So it's kind of the perfect Yeats segue.
Rosie, this is why Rosie Schapp is brilliant. I didn't know this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See how this works?
This works.
It's like cross-pollination.
All right, so let's hear the Yeats poem.
A coat or the drinking one?
A coat.
Let's just hear a coat.
Let's do the coat.
It's a fantastic poem. It's from Responsibilities. I made my song a coat covered with embroideries out of old mythologies from heel to throat. But the fools caught it, wore it in the world's eyes as though they'd wrought it. Song, let them take it, for there's more enterprise in walking naked.
I had no idea until this moment that this... See, people have told me, in some ways, poetry is all about other poetry, and it's all a big fun house.
Well, Harold Bloom would certainly tell you that.
And I was like, no, it's not. But that's actually just because I don't get the references all the time. So I'm reading them in a sort of disembodied form.
So let's hear the Yeats drinking song that you wanted to read.
It's a little tiny thing, but a very pretty little tiny thing. Wine comes in at the mouth, and love comes in at the eye. That's all we shall know for truth before we grow old and die. I lift the glass to my mouth. I look at you and I sigh.
That's like a toast. Don't you
feel
like?
It's amazing.
It is.
In fact, let's toast.
To a woman who would never marry him.
To Maud Gonne, probably.
Probably. I would think so.
The famous beauty Maud Gonne who Yeats never...
The famous Meshuggah beauty Maud Gonne.
Stop. Stop. It's too much.
Okay, so moving right along, after Yeats...
We got to hear some Frank O'Hara, because we're in New York.
Yeah. We just heard from Kenneth Cook. Let's hear from his friend, his pal, Frank O'Hara.
I'm on a huge Manhattan kick in terms of my drinking.
So we've heard.
And a huge Frank O'Hara kick in terms of my reading. I derive more and more pleasure from his work as the years go by, and I get it more and more. At first, I didn't understand sort of what he was doing, and it seemed too casual, too tossed off and conversational. But as I inhabit New York City for a longer amount of time and inhabit the world of poetry for a longer amount of time, I get it more deeply, and I just, it's just pleasure. It gives me delight.
I feel the same way, and I had the same, I think, initial feelings about O'Hara, that it was too colloquial and too breezy and maybe a little too easy in some way. Mm. But years ago when I taught poetry, I remember teaching The Day Lady Died, and it's just like he's going about his ordinary daily life and picking up a newspaper and dropping a few names and walking around town, and then the ending just hits you so hard and brings the whole poem together. It's really affecting.
I'm not reading that poem, by the way.
Well, of course not.
Of course. But I'm reading As Planned. Do you know this poem?
I don't think I do.
It's one of Frank O'Hara's minor works, I think. But
he did write a lot before his untimely demise. Yes.
It's not The Day Lady Died, but it is sort of a delightful little meringue about drunkenness and drinking. And anyway, do you want me to read it, Curtis?
Yeah, please.
Okay. As Planned. After the first glass of vodka, you can accept just about anything of life, even your own mysteriousness. You think it is nice that a box of matches is purple and brown and is called La Petite and comes from Sweden, for they are words that you know, and that is all you know. Words, not their feelings or what they mean. And you write because you know them, not because you understand them, because you don't. You are stupid and lazy and will never be great, but you do what you know, because what else is there?
I liked how you really hit the word nice, because I feel like nice is one of those words that only a Frank O'Hara could get away with using.
Only
Frank
O'Hara. And
it's really the right word.
There's that kind of delirium that hits you, you know, maybe a drink and a half in, where the world starts shimmering and wavering, and there's a kind of, you know, that's a strange... pleasurable destabilization that takes hold, and I think that's what he's kind of capturing there. Where you start looking at the matchbox and you start thinking about your whole life, and maybe I won't achieve greatness. Oh well, I'm here.
The poem, in some ways, and especially at the ending, that kind of not exactly defeated, but well, what are we going to do with all this anyway? It made me think of Pavesi, and it made me recall exactly what I also should have brought tonight.
Grappa in September.
Exactly.
That's a great
exactly.
poem.
Exactly. A great poem.
That's a great... Why did we not bring that?
Why did we not bring that? Because
we're
complete idiots. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So here's a question for you, both of you. What do you think the relationship between drinking and poetry is? Not as from the point of view of a writer, but almost from the point of view of a reader. How do they connect in your mind?
You go.
I don't know. I mean... I think that's an interesting question. I'd never thought of it at all before. But I will say that recently when I've had people over for dinner and we've eaten a lot and drunk a lot, I've noticed the, you know, I like to think that most people I know and love poetry as much as I do, but it's not true. But I find, you know, with a few drinks, everyone's quite patient with poetry.
But doesn't poetry sort of open up, or drinking opens up veins of feeling that normally you wouldn't give access to in your normal guarded self?
Yeah, here's the thing. There is a world. There is another world. And we can access it. And there's different ways we can access it. And poetry is
part of...
It's just
very hieratic there for a moment, Jeff. I like that.
I know. Doors of perception. It's doors of perception I'm talking about, Curtis, Rosie, you know what I mean.
So the bar is very slowly filling up with couples and nice crowds. I think it's your turn, Jeff, to come up with another poem, another drinking poem.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
So what do you have for us?
Well, I had Andrew Hudgens' Praying Drunk, which I just want to mention. I think everyone should seek it out. I believe it's on the Poetry Foundation site. It's sublime. It's a little long for our purposes, so I don't think it's really necessarily right for this, but seek it out.
It's great.
What about a poem that succeeds in having fun?
That succeeds in having fun?
No.
Okay. Tony Hoagland is a poet who is skilled at delivering pleasure, I think, in entertaining the reader.
And one of the funniest poets around.
He's very funny. Yeah. And yet, I would argue that he's probably one of the angriest American poets alive. There's actually this undercurrent of rage and frustration in a lot of his work. He and Dean Young, the great Dean Young, are friends.
Very good friends.
Yeah.
Close
and
friends.
In fact, they write poems about each other and sort of reference each other. And so there's a Tony Hoagland poem about Dean Young and Dean Young's narrative affection for wine that it seems so fun. It's fun to read, it's fun to come across, but it's actually not about fun. It's really about how maybe, when you get to the last lines, if you'll indulge me, you'll see what I mean. It's
okay.
actually sort of about how this affection for wine is rooted in pain.
So this is called When Dean Young Talks About Wine.
Dean Young Talks About Wine, that's right.
By Tony Hoagland.
The worm thrashes when it enters the tequila. The grape cries out in the wine vat crusher. But when Dean Young talks about wine, his voice is strangely calm. Yet it seems that wine is rarely mentioned. He says, great first chapter, but no plot. He says, long runway, short flight. He says, this one never had a secret. He says, you can't wear stripes with that. He squints, as if recalling his childhood in France. He purses his lips and shakes his head at the glass. 84 was a naughty year, he says. And for a second, I worry that California has turned him into a sushi eater in a cravat. Then he says, this one makes clear the difference between a thoughtless remark and an unwarranted intrusion. Then he says, in this one, the Pacific last light of afternoon stains the wings of the seagull pink at the very edge of the postcard. But where is the Cabernet of rent checks and asthma medication? Where is the Burgundy of orthopedic shoes? Where is the Chablis of skinned knees and jelly sandwiches with the aftertaste of cruel Little League coaches and the undertone of rusty station wagon? His mouth is purple as if from his own ventricle he had drunk. He sways like a fishing rod. When a beast is hurt, it roars in incomprehension. When a bird is hurt, it huddles in its nest. But when a man is hurt, he makes himself an expert. Then he stands there with a glass in his hand, staring into nothing, as if he was forming an opinion.
Wow. That poem took a turn from...
That's fun?
Yeah.
I said it started fun. A lot of my poems I've chosen seem to start fun
and then end
sad.
Well, that's the story.
I'm worried about that, Curtis. Can you talk to me about it?
So we have time for one more poem, and I want to ask you, Rosie, do you have one more?
Well, I have this Karen Carson.
Karen Carson is an Irish poet I know nothing about, and you have very high praise for him. So I want to hear a little bit about him and then the poem.
Karen Carson is a Belfast-born and bred poet with a really fascinating history. You know, growing up in Belfast when he did, I think he's just over 60 now, in a Catholic family, in an Irish-speaking home. His parents had learned Irish and spoke it. You know, there were a lot of statements being made in that kind of household. Music was also incredibly important, and he's, by many people, as highly regarded as a flutist as he is as a poet. And this one is called Hippocrene. Tomato juice, black pepper, Worcester sauce, a dash, Tabasco, salt, the vodka measured to your taste, ice cubes, ditto. Then sip this freezing balderdash. Think about it. It is not to be consumed in haste. Immediately ensanguined, your lips tremble and burn as if they'd got a massive intravenous shot of hemoglobin and you're drinking from a Grecian urn. The bar you understand you're in is called the Elfin Grot. Karaoke singers mouth their lip-sync rhymes. Tape loop music tinkles harp arpeggios of ice. The videos are showing scenes of ancient times. Here is Moscow burning, horses led to slaughter, wandering the snowy waste of martial sacrifice, trails of blood emblazoned in the frozen water.
My God, it sounds like he's in a bar drinking a Bloody Mary.
That's about a Bloody Mary.
It's about a Bloody Mary.
As a wasp, I can tell you, that's all about a Bloody Mary.
But watching a Tarkovsky movie.
But
is it Tarkovsky?
He's all about themes. He always has these themes woven in. And Eyebright or a hotel. Or like, there's always something woven in.
In this book, there's a lot about war, a lot that's very hallucinogenic. Yeah.
But he really takes the idea of Bloody Mary and takes it to an extreme.
Yeah.
Like, it's, as with many of the poems we've encountered tonight, it takes a dark turn, but in this case, a kind of epic one.
Right.
We're about to have our third drink, and we don't want to inflict that on listeners. So I want to...
Where we draw the line.
Yeah. So I want to thank you both for coming on to the program. Look for Jeff Gordon-Near's articles on poetryfoundation.org and in the New York Times dining section. And in what month should we expect your book?
I don't know.
That's good enough.
Time is a fiction.
And sometime in the next year or two, Rosie Schapp's new book, Drinking with Men, will come out. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Curtis.
Thank you so much.
Let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is...
You can't wear stripes without.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for bearing with us.